And actually, even in Brazil until quite recently, there was a good news story there in terms of how government, through implementing its own policies, was beginning to reduce the deforestation rate. And in the years after around 2006, 2007, 2008, there was a very significant reduction in deforestation. But of course, we've seen a very different tone coming from the top of the Brazilian government in recent times, with the new president, Jair Bolsonaro, explicitly stating his view that he believes the Amazon needs to be cleared in order to facilitate the country's development, which, apart from being very wrong, has actually been quite influential, because evidently some of the landowning interests in Brazil have responded to his idea that the Amazon needn't be protected by actually lighting fires in order to clear more land to open up for soybean production and for the production of beef, some of which, of course, is going into global markets. So we're seeing a reversal of a long-standing policy. And this is one that not only affects Brazil, of course, but affects the whole world.
That's a bit from this week's special interview with Tony Juniper, a campaigner, writer, sustainability advisor, and leading British environmentalist. On this episode, we discuss about the Amazon forest fires, why tropical rainforests are essential, and many more. Hello and welcome to the Mission Junior podcast. Here as always, your host Girish Shivakumar. One of the major global headlines in 2019 was Amazon rainforest wildfires. Just like most of you, I had a lot of questions and I was curious to find out the finer details. And that's when I got in touch with Tony Juniper. I'm glad that I could finally get time with Tony and record this podcast interview. Tony Juniper is a renowned global environmentalist. Rainforest is of special interest to Tony. In fact, his recent book is titled Rainforest: Dispatches from the Earth's Most Vital Frontlines. Tony's works have been globally recognized, and in 2017, he was appointed a Commander of the Order of British Empire. So with that brief introduction, let's hear from Tony Juniper. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the Mission Junior podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. So welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
So for someone who has been at the forefront of international activities over the last few decades, how does he go about summarizing his work?
Well, I would describe myself as an environmentalist. I've been working in the field now for 35 years, more or less. I've been lucky enough to enjoy many different roles. I've worked as a scientist, for example, with BirdLife International. Back in the 1980s, I've worked with the Wildlife Trusts in the UK. In the 1980s and again more recently as their national president. I have worked for a long time at Friends of the Earth, helping to run the Tropical Rainforest Campaign there, amongst other things, and then was the director of that organization for a long period. I've helped the Prince of Wales and His Royal Highness's sustainability activities in different ways, including on tropical forest conservation. I've been an advisor to companies. I've worked with many private sector organizations as a result of that, many different sectors. And I've written some books about conservation, worked with some other NGOs, including WWF, helping them to develop their campaigns. And more recently, I was appointed as the chairman of the UK government's Nature Conservation Agency in England, an organization called Natural England.
Tony, that's a phenomenal track record. I mean, I have had the pleasure to listen to a couple of your lectures while I was in Cambridge. And so as listeners probably will now realize like why I have you on the podcast for this special episode.
Well, thank you.
Now, to start with, what was your first reaction when you heard about the Amazon forest fire in the recent months?
Well, it's rather sad to hear news being repeated that we were hearing back literally in the 1980s, when many of the campaigns to save the tropical rainforests were really getting going as a result of exactly this kind of thing. And since the 1980s, it is good to see that we've made enormous progress in terms of public awareness, in terms of the appetite of many governments to want to help conserve the tropical rainforests. We've got more protected areas across the tropical countries. And in some places, we've seen some very real progress towards slowing down, if not reversing, the damage. And actually, even in Brazil until quite recently, there was a good news story there in terms of how government, through implementing its own policies, was beginning to reduce the deforestation rate. And in the years after around 2006, 7, 8, there was a very significant reduction in deforestation. But of course, we've seen a very different tone coming from the top of the Brazilian government in recent times, with the new president, Jair Bolsonaro, explicitly stating his view that he believes the Amazon needs to be cleared in order to facilitate the country's development, which, apart from being very wrong, has actually been quite influential, because evidently some of the landowning interests in Brazil have responded to his idea that the Amazon needn't be protected by actually lighting fires in order to clear more land to open up for soybean production and for the production of beef, some of which, of course, is going into global markets. So we're seeing a reversal of a long-standing policy, and this is one that not only affects Brazil, of course, but affects the whole world.
That perfectly leads me to my next question, Tony, because people generally hear about this in the newspapers saying that the Amazon forest has a significant impact on the global weather and climate pattern. So what is the importance of rainforest in general? Why are rainforests really essential for the whole planet?
The rainforests are the tropical rainforests are amongst the most important terrestrial ecosystems on our planet. And as we witness these terrible fires, literally thousands of them, tearing through the forests of South America, there is the release of vast quantities of carbon dioxide as the plant material is being turned into emissions. And that, of course, is something that is helping to drive the climate change problem. And whilst we tend to focus on aeroplanes and cars and power stations, quite rightly, as major sources of emissions, it's important to remember that deforestation globally is putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than all of global transport combined. So it is very significant. And actually, in some ways, even more significant than that in terms of global security is the extent to which these forests are vital in the global water cycle. And I sometimes point out to decision makers that the clue is in the name of these ecosystems. They are called rainforests for a reason, and not only because rain falls upon them, but because they pump literally billions of tons of moisture into the atmosphere every single day, which helps clouds to form. And some of those clouds form and moisten land very far away from the forests. And this is where President Bolsonaro might wish to quickly review his policy that these forests are a block to the development of his country. In fact, the forests intact are vital for the development of his country. The forests are worth far more alive than dead, not least because they are putting into the atmosphere the water that is in turn falling as rain, which is helping Brazil to be a major agricultural exporter. It's helping to power the factories of the southern part of the country, the industrial heartlands. And the president might also wish to reflect on the fact that 80% of Brazil's electricity is coming from hydroelectric dams. And those dams are having their turbines powered by rivers. And those rivers are being topped up by rain. And that rain is coming from the rainforest. So this is a vital set of ecosystem services in terms of climate change and water, never mind the biodiversity or the protection of soils, which are essential for human civilization and well-being and food security, and indeed energy and water security. So the destruction of these systems, even though it seems to some eyes like a rational economic choice that we're facilitating economic growth by liquidating the rainforests, It is illusory growth. It's very short term. And in the end, the costs will be far, far bigger in economic terms than the gains that we're getting in the short term. So globally, we need a program to not only halt deforestation, but to reverse it. And we've seen in one or two countries where this is happening. And so we know it's possible to do that.
That's a well-structured answer, Tony. Before I go on to how the global governments from across the world have reacted to the situation, I just want you to go deep into explain the cyclic effect. You briefly mentioned about how a period of drought and lack of rainfall affects the deforestation, and that probably kind of increases the chances of forest fires. Is this true to an extent?
Yes, and one of the things about the Amazon rainforest is the extent to which it is a single hydrological system. And the way it works is to evaporate water from the forest into the atmosphere. And that water vapor turns into clouds. And as it does so, it's drawing moisture from the ocean into the interior of South America. And as it's doing that, moisture is spilling out of the Amazon north and south. Some of the water falling on the croplands of North America as far north as Manitoba in Canada, and some of those huge grain fields up there are in part being moistened by water pumped into the atmosphere from the forests of Central and South America. And then the moisture is going to the south as well. And people call these movements of moisture sky rivers. And that moisture is only going to flow in those sky rivers so long as the forest is still there. And as the forest becomes fragmented, so it starts to change its properties. And in some parts of Brazil already, the rainfall over the rainforest is going down because the forest is already broken up. Large areas have been cleared. And some scientists wonder and indeed worry that at some point the entire system will collapse and it will no longer be a rainforest because of its fragmentation and degradation. It will start turning into savanna and into grassland, and that will have major implications for water security far beyond the area of the forest itself, and indeed well into South America and well into North America as well as and indeed possibly even Southern Africa. So this is a major set of consequences that could have really quite serious economical and social ramifications, but which are barely discussed by politicians. And again, President Bolsonaro might like to look at the stresses and strains experienced in his country in 2014, when there was a very severe drought. Reservoirs ran dry, power supplies were cut as a result of hydroelectric dams no longer working, agricultural output was hit, and Brazilian scientists were linking the severity and longevity of that drought to deforestation in the Amazon. And so the fires that we're seeing this year could be a threat to Brazilian security rather than the president would have it, a contribution to economic growth.
This certainly looks like a short-sighted effort by the president. But considering the effect it's going to have on the world as it is, do you think the governments from, like say, for example, the other major countries, did they do enough to curb what was happening?
Well, there has been a long running dialogue between the Brazilian government and the countries of the Western world. And indeed, as long ago as 1991, when I was working at Friends of the Earth running the Tropical Rainforest Campaign there, there was a program launched by the G7 countries at their meeting in London that year, a so-called pilot program for the Brazilian Amazon. And this was a very good attempt by the Germans, Americans, British, and the rest of the G7 to try and resource sustainable development in the Amazon region. And it did have some benefits. But of course, the problem never really goes away, and it's going to require long-term commitment and long-term partnership to be able to slow down and reverse deforestation. It's not something that can be easily solved through the kind of fashion effect, if you will. When these issues get into the headlines, countries tend to be more inclined to do something, but that's not sufficient. It needs a long track record of cooperation, of deep partnership to be able to keep these things in the good direction that they need to be in. And unfortunately, the interest kind of goes up and down, and the changes in Brazilian politics, the changes in politics in the United States, these shifts in opinion and perspective, of course, don't allow us to develop the kind of long-term plans that we need. And that's then really a question of awareness in leaders as to the importance of these systems and the extent to which we really do need to remain focused on their conservation. And so the political realm does need constant reinforcement as to the need for diplomatic relations, for cooperation, for partnership, for funding. On the other side, and this is where actually there is probably more consistent activity at the moment, is the extent to which the private sector and companies that have supply chains in agricultural produce and natural resources are actually putting in the effort to make sure that the stuff that's going into the products that we all buy as consumers doesn't have deforestation linked with the way in which those commodities or resources were produced. And there's a lot of effort coming from some of the world's biggest consumer goods brands and supermarkets at the moment who are saying, actually, you know, we'd like to sell products that don't have deforestation involved in their production. And I do think that that kind of commercial pressure coming into Brazil over the coming years could be very significant in changing the perspective of the leaders there as to the desirability of continuing with deforestation, especially if countries like India and China and some of their major suppliers and buyers of commodities begin to take a similar view. And I think that's beginning to happen in China, at least, and hopefully we'll see that more widely too.
That's an interesting point that you bring about, because as you rightly said, major brands, especially from North America, have taken a hard stand on saying that we are not going to sell that product because it's coming from Brazil and we're not sure if Brazil is doing it the right way. So that's an interesting point. Now, you did mention about the lack of political will to an extent by the governments in getting an agreement or getting into a discussion in this phase. From your experience, do you think there has been a successful case study of how a country has taken environmental conservation on a positive note?
Yes, I would say my favorite example of a tropical rainforest country that has taken a very different path to the one that Brazil is presently embarked upon is the small Central American country of Costa Rica, where back in the 1980s, the leaders of the country took the view that the tropical rainforests there were actually worth more to the country intact and functioning ecologically than they were cleared away and opened up for cattle ranching, for example. And so for 30 years, Costa Rica has invested in a very effective conservation program. And this was predicated on the idea that the forests would supply fresh water. They would be important for energy security because of the way in which rain would supply hydroelectric dams and the way in which rain would help to water crops and enable the country to also be an agricultural exporter. And over the years since that policy was adopted, the country has become a major destination for ecological tourism. So many millions of people have visited Costa Rica to see the forest, to experience the wonderful wildlife. And that now has made that particular sector of the economy, tourism, the biggest single source of revenue for the nation. And this is all built upon looking after the forest and keeping them intact and having them accessible as national parks and other reserves that people can visit. And so that's a completely different approach to that being adopted by Brazil at the moment, but is an approach which is evidently more economically valuable as well as ecologically more sustainable. And if you look at what Costa Rica has done over a 30-year period, not only has it doubled its forest cover, at the same time, it has also doubled per capita GDP, thereby proving that you can have development that at the same time sustains and expands the forest cover. And I'm sure other countries could find similarly compelling business cases for their national development strategies if only they would look beyond the very short term and would look beyond the chorus of vested interests who can benefit from short-term destruction of these incredible ecological assets.
At this point, it is well worth a moment to reflect the Costa Rica story and compare with what's happening in Brazil. And just like you during the chat with Tony, even I was totally immersed in the conversation and stories that he had to share, which then led me to ask, where did it all start for you? How did you get so passionate about environmental conservation?
Yes, it's a very good question, Girish. I began my interest in all of this at a very, very early age, actually. The first things I can remember as a small child is being interested in plants and in animals, and that interest grew into a passion for natural history, to go and look for birds, to understand how nature works, to have a passion for fossils and plants and rivers and fish, and all of these things that have stayed with me all of my life. And as one takes an interest in the natural world, of course, you can't help but be aware of what's happening to it. And so that love of nature then turns into a concern and a willingness and passion to be involved in conservation. And that's really where I life took me. I had a period at university studying a zoology degree initially, and that led me into the choice of whether I would like to pursue a career in research or whether I would like to join the conservation world. And I did the latter, and have spent the last 35 years, therefore, working on all of these subjects. And, you know, I think we've seen some progress over time. We have an awful lot more to do, but at least we have made a good start in getting people to understand the implications of some of this stuff.
That's an interesting journey. I'm sure a lot of people who are doing their work, probably like even like me, need to get into that mode, like have that passion to pursue what we are doing.
Yes.
Before I go into my final question, I'm sure a lot of listeners probably are from across the pond as well. And they would probably thinking about the other fires that generally get more attention these days, the California fires. I'm sure there are not much comparisons because of different regions and geographical locations, but what is your take on that?
Well, the fires that have raged through parts of the western United States in recent years, especially in California, obviously have had devastating consequences for people there. Truly awful stories of people's homes being destroyed and loss of life and really tragic outcomes occurring. But very different circumstances to the fires that have burnt in the Amazon recently, not least because these are very different ecological systems. Those temperate forests occurring along the western side of the U.S. are very different in character to those in the Amazon basin. And indeed, some of those forests in North America, they are so-called fire climax ecosystems that reach a certain ecological character as a result of fire being part of the way in which they change and regenerate over time. And certainly there are some climate change kinds of implications in this, in terms of very high temperatures, very long drought, making these systems very dry and prone to fire. But also over many decades, the forestry practices there have been about suppressing fire. And so if you suppress fire, you finish up with more wood building up. And as that wood builds up and it becomes very dry, then when the fires do occur, they become very serious indeed. And as a result of changes in the U.S. Timber market over recent years, I understand that there's been a drop in demand for some kinds of wood as a result, for example, of fewer wooden houses being built. And that's led to more wood being left in the forest rather than being harvested, again, thereby adding to the kinds of fire burden that could occur should these places catch a light, which they have done. So it's quite a complicated picture there. And so you have a combination of factors that play in different ways, including, you know, the interruption of natural forest dynamics through fire suppression, changes in the way the forest industry has been working. Plus, on top of that, you have the potential impacts of climate change with long, hot, dry conditions. And then, of course, blend into that the fact that many towns and cities are built in areas of dense forest, and you find that you have circumstances that can lead to these really quite disruptive and tragic outcomes. But it's different to Brazil, and I would hope that in the United States, the foresters and the land managers and the conservation groups can be working with residents who live in areas that are prone to these kinds of fires to be coming forward with plans for the future that can ensure that the forests remain there in a good way for wildlife and for people to enjoy, but the fire risk at the same time can be reduced. And I would have thought that would be possible once we've understood all the different ways in which these factors interact with one another in creating these conditions that can lead to the to these kinds of conflagrations that we've seen during recent years.
As rightly said, there are a lot of scenarios as to why a certain event occurs, like the forest fires in California. The system dynamics have to be studied in detail. So for someone who has worked in the space for a long time, does Tony feel that he is better prepared or equipped with relevant information on the environmental systems in recent years as compared to when he started over two decades ago?
Yes, I personally certainly feel better equipped in terms of the arguments that environmentalists can make today. And one of the reasons for that, Girish, is the extent to which we are now better able to articulate an economic and social rationale for what we want to do to reduce pollution, to make the energy system more sustainable, to conserve soils, to protect wildlife. All of these things that we've been trying to do, we now today have a much stronger set of arguments as to why we want to do that. And I mentioned that economic rationale because I don't think that in the end we have a series of environmental problems. I think what we have is a series of economic failures. We have an economic system that is in the process of destroying itself by removing the natural systems that enable it to exist in the first place. And so being able to articulate an economic rationale for why we need to change, I think, is giving us a very powerful way of engaging people who are in the most powerful positions in the world, the people running the financial sector, the people running the finance and economics ministries of governments. We need to convince them that the way we conceive economic strategy needs to be embedded inside an ecological envelope. And at the moment, we've got it completely the other way around. At the moment, we assume that endless economic growth can continue untrammeled long into the future. But of course, it can't because it's changing the climate. It's destroying the natural resource base. It's removing the essential services of water, soil, pollinators, fish stocks, and all the rest. And if we are going to have an economic system that can meet people's needs long into the future, then we need to rebuild the ecological system that needs to operate for the economy to function. And so we can now articulate that, and we've got study after study. We have all the data we need. And so I do feel as though we're in a much stronger position in terms of the argument we can make, because for too long, the world assumed that environmental destruction was the price of progress, that economic growth had to be achieved first and foremost, and that we would regrettably but inevitably have to accept damage to nature as part of that process. We now can say for certain, no, that was wrong. If we want to have development into the future, first we have to restore the environment to make that possible. So that's incredibly important. And that shift in perspective is beginning to be seen in policy making and in the way in which the financial system thinks about its future. And the other thing which is now very much more in evidence is the extent to which we have public backing for action. And certainly in this country, in the UK, and I would hope in other places too, you can see this upwelling of public demand for things to be done. And that is beginning to influence the choices made by our political leaders, and that's to be welcomed. And so it could be that over these coming few years, maybe the next decade, we finally see the breakthroughs that we've been waiting for, and we finally see the beginnings of what would truly be a sustainable economy, because that is the direction that we have to go in. There is no rational alternative to that. The question is, can we get sufficient momentum quickly enough? And the stakes now are very high because we know that we're already on the cusp of triggering potentially very dangerous climate change, never mind the collapse of ecosystems like the Amazon that we've talked about. Hopefully, the next few years will see us reaching the turning point where we can walk away from the brink of disaster, and to do that as a global community united in our commitments to genuinely sustainable development.
That's wonderful, Tony. I think that's very well put. So it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you very much for taking time to come on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you, Girish.
And with that, we bring to end yet another episode on the Mission Junior podcast. To know more about Tony's work, you can check his website, tonyjuniper.com. You can also follow him on Twitter. He goes by the handle at @TonyJuniper. As always, I hope you liked the episode and the conversation. If yes, please do let me know. You can also share the episode to a friend or a colleague and help spread the word. You can write to me at missionchunia@gmail.com or through Facebook, Twitter or Instagram. Go by the handle at @missionchunia. 2 weeks from now, you'll have yet another podcast episode coming your way. So subscribe now if you haven't done yet. The podcast is available on all major platforms for Apple and Android devices like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Gaana, JioSaavn, Amazon Alexa, and many more. For all information related to Mission Junia, visit missionchunia.com. So with that, signing off, this is Mission Junia, towards a zero carbon economy.